What even is Fungal Punk? Hi, my name is Marco and welcome to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. My guest this week is Adrian M. Gibson. He's a speculative fiction author, podcaster, illustrator, and sometimes a tattoo artist. His upcoming exciting debut novel Mushroom Blues is the first one in the Hoffman Report series and also the first one set in the secondary interconnected world of Fungalverse. The genre is Fungal Punk, police procedural murder mystery that combines the elements of such works as Blade Runner, True Detective and District 9 with the weird worlds of China Mieville and Jeff Vandermeer. We talked about his obsession with mushrooms, real-life events that inspire his work, creating immersive experiences with your book, our love for Disco Elysium and many more exciting topics. So let's dive into the Fungalverse and start this week's storyline session with Adrian M. Gibson. Enjoy! Hi, Adrian. Welcome to Storyline Sessions. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Well, I've been getting into the Fungalverse, as you named it, and I've been really enjoying it so far. So first off, I have to ask, why fungi? How did that come about? Not just story-wise, but like you, as you said on your socials, you're kind of obsessed with them. And as I can see behind you, there are some fungi on the dashboard. So give us an intro into your Fungalverse.
Yeah, so fungi is just something that I've been interested in for a long time. And most of it stems from childhood, growing up on the West Coast in British Columbia. I would just go play in the forest. I would hang out in my parents' backyard, and the temperate rainforest kind of environment and climate of the West Coast is really conducive for fungi to grow and survive and thrive. And so we just find them all the time in our backyard or in the forest, and I would just kind of like pick them up and like break them open and look at them and see what's going on. But my conception of fungi and mushrooms was always like the mushroom itself. It took a long time for me to realize that there's so much more going on beneath the surface with mycelium and the different interactions that mycelium has with its environment. And that kind of flourished after high school when I just started reading more about it. And I have the internet to thank for it, because it helped me stumble across different authors and mycologists, whether professional or amateur, and just reading their stuff and reading different books and reading mushroom field guides and looking at the different varieties of mushrooms and why a particular environment is suited for a particular mushroom to grow in. And yeah, it's just grown exponentially over the course of my life. And then in my 20s, or in my late teens and into my 20s, I started experimenting a lot with psychedelics, with psilocybin mushrooms and with LSD and different stuff. And that kind of opened my eyes and my mind to different ways in which mushrooms can interact with the human body. So it's kind of like there's the more natural side where you're looking at the mushrooms and touching them and experimenting and all that kind of stuff and eating them, and the ways in which mushrooms are incorporated into different cuisines is also really fascinating to me. But then the psychedelic is just a whole other spectrum of how mushrooms can affect the sort of like biology and psychology of human beings. And it's beautiful. So it's like the full breadth of what mushrooms can do is just beautiful.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I was a while back, I saw this documentary, I'm blanking on the name now, but about the psychoactive component of mushrooms, but overall of the use of mushrooms in medicine and people who use them in alternative ways. But it's like super spread, and it's really a fascinating topic. And yeah. When did you figure out like this fascination of yours could be mixed with the things that you're interested in writing and fitting them into your stories?
Jeff Vandermeer really opened my eyes to that. Most people probably know him from his book Annihilation, which was adapted into a movie. And the Southern Reach trilogy and Annihilation are incredible novels. And Annihilation really is the novel that convinced me that I wanted to be a writer. But after I'd read Annihilation, I also read his Ambergris trilogy with City of Saints and Mad Men, Shriek, and Finch. And Ambergris is basically this city of humans who forced the fungal sort of denizens of this area to go underground. And then the novels take place in a period when the fungal people rise up and basically recolonize the colonizers who had originally colonized them. So it's this really kind of like meta narrative in that sense of about post-colonialism and anti-colonialism. And to me, it was really fascinating because he presented mushrooms in a way where they're both scary and uncanny, and at the same time, fascinating and beautiful and magical. And so this kind of dichotomy really stuck with me. And the fact that he was able to blend mushrooms into like a fantasy world just kind of showed me that it was possible to genre blend in such a way where mushrooms don't necessarily have to be like the genre that this book encapsulates, but it can be a really major player in what's going on there. And so years later, when I had a dream of a giant bioluminescent mushroom in the forest, kind of towering over the trees and just, you know, spores floating around in the air, it really clicked something in my head where I thought, okay, I'm going to push forward with this. I'm actually going to do something with this. And I started researching more. I started doing a ton of world building, a lot of illustration as well. And what happened is I got just really, really bogged down in doing all that stuff, but not writing, which is the thing that matters. Mm. So I was writing, but I wasn't necessarily writing a narrative.
I was just kind of procrastinating by researching.
Exactly, by researching, by world building, which are traps that writers can fall into. And it's totally, totally understandable. And a lot of writers have experienced this, you know, where they spend like years doing Tolkien level world building, but then they don't actually write the story. And so for me, I realized like everything that I was doing, it wasn't a waste of time because it did get me to a point where I understood the potency of this world, but the narratives that I had conceived of set in that world were just pretty just meh and too preachy, and the kind of execution that I wanted to go for, I wasn't skilled enough to do with what I'd set out at that point. And so I started pulling in different genres like Jeff Vandermeer did, noir and detective stories and police procedurals and murder mysteries, cyberpunk and more like sci-fi elements, and just kind of like smashing that together with this foundation of a mushroom world with mushroom people and kind of ideas of colonialism and how humans and these mushroom people and their cultures would clash in this story.
And speaking of culture and colonialism and those strong themes, I can't help but feel that like a lot of the culture, especially in the way that names are constructed, speech, honorifics, stuff like that, are hugely Asian inspired, more specifically mm-hmm. Japan. Is that so? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, completely.
And how did that come about? Was that kind of a theme of from the beginning, or you just kind of stumbled your way into it? Did you know, okay, this magical world of dark themes and mushrooms should be set in kind of a neo-futuristic alternative history Japan, or is it something that kind of came a little bit later as an aesthetic?
It's very much rooted in the creation of the world. And much like mushrooms, my fascinations with Japan and Japanese culture and Japanese history goes way back to when I was a kid. Obviously, when I was a kid, I think it was much more aesthetic driven in terms of anime and samurai and sushi and kind of like the food that I was interested in. But as I got older, much like mushrooms, I went into a ton of different rabbit holes, sort of immersing myself in aspects of Japan that really fascinated me beyond kind of the surface level stuff. And so I delved deep into Japanese history, you know, just like I love reading about Japanese history and and learning about it and Japanese customs and cuisine and the complexities that exist within their culture and their language and their religions. And so when I started developing the early versions of the Fungalverse, this was very much rooted in that stage where I was kind of combining elements of Japanese culture with fungi in such a way that I could present readers with this world that is unfamiliar and familiar at the same time, and also just go so deep into it that I could show everybody how amazing mushrooms are and how amazing Japanese culture is. And it also just kind of fit naturally within the evolution of it as well, in terms of when I went beyond that first stage and into writing the book that I wrote before Mushroom Blues and then Mushroom Blues itself. A lot of the things that crop up in history in Japan and sort of like Japan's relationship with other countries, those were really fitting and present themes in the book itself. So colonialism is a huge thing in terms of Japan being this like isolationist country for a long time, and then the sort of forced introduction of the West and Western customs and Western ideas and philosophies. And that kind of changed the course of that nation drastically over the course of a very short amount of time. And then, of course, World War II and everything that happened with World War II and the rise of the Japanese Empire as a part of the Axis with Germany and Italy, and the ways in which World War II ended and the destruction that occurred in Japan and the occupation of Japan by Allied forces as well. All of that felt so perfect for the discussions that I was having in this book, where the mushroom people are isolationist in the sense that they're a branch of humanity that verged off and became isolated on an archipelago and symbiotically merged with really powerful mushrooms and became mushroom people. And then at the same time, the ways in which a human society and a human government decides to invade them and occupy them, and kind of playing on that narrative that Jeff Vandermeer was doing as well, in terms of the colonizers becoming the colonized and conversations about colonialism and post-colonialism. And all of that just fit so naturally within the narrative of this world.
Yeah, for sure. And it comes true for real. And I think that that's something, one of the strongest themes that I felt when I was reading the part that I got so far. And another thing, when I read some of the influences that you listed when you introduced the book to me, was China Mieville. Mm-hmm. Whose work I really appreciate. I was so happy when I saw his name among those others, and I was like, yeah. And as soon as I got into like few pages deep, I was like, yeah, City and the City comes through, but not in a derivative way, of course, not to put down your work, but mm-hmm. kind of like a strong mix of that with some other things. And for me, that was interesting because as you were talking about Japan and those issues of colonialism and separation between people, that's really interesting seeing not a lot of modern, for at least in my opinion, not a lot of modern fantasy sci-fi authors take into consideration such like social political themes. And of course we do get that, but it's far more often in just regular fiction with some crime thrillers and stuff that's in our world or set in some alternate history, but still contemporary in some way. And for me, that's really interesting seeing that seep into this. And how did that come about? You mentioned your interest for Japan as you were a kid. And also for me, what's interesting is you've moved, you currently live in Ecuador. So maybe we can get some kind of an origin story of that, because I think that intertwines with your story.
Yeah, I think for me, a lot of it has to do with traveling and just living in other places. And I'm glad that you brought up that comparison to The City and the City. I love that book so much. And I actually read that book when I was living in Berlin, which was so poignant because The City and the City is about, you know, a city that is essentially divided, but it's divided in such a way where people are culturally programmed to not see each other. And so there's sort of like a very stark dividing line between these different cultures that exist within the city, but they could be walking right next to each other and just not notice one another. And so it's kind of like this this cultural blindness that they have. And it was really crazy to live in Berlin and be reading that book, because Berlin is a city that was literally divided between the Soviets and between the Allied powers, but with this big wall in between. And so it was wild for me to see, you know, the portions of the wall that still exist, but also the ways in which different parts of the city or different sides of the city exist in different states of development, different states of sort of wealth and affluence, different states of, you know, subcultures and even immigrant cultures that inhabit certain parts of the city. And so for me, it's always been really important to live in different places, to live in different places and to experience other cultures in such a way where I can begin to understand how they live and empathize with the individuals who are still alive, but also understand the complexities of their history. And for me, history is a big part of everything that I do. I love reading about history, and it goes beyond just Japan. It kind of straddles the line between all different cultures around the world, but also the history of war, and the history of colonialism and all these different things. And so being able to live in a place like Berlin, where I lived for 3 years, and then coming to Ecuador after I met my now wife in Barcelona. She's Ecuadorian, and so I was kind of burnt out on Europe and decided, like, fuck it, I'm gonna go to Ecuador with you. And ended up moving here, but then Ecuador and South America has its own history and cultural and sociopolitical complexities surrounding big things in my life in terms of colonialism, the Spanish conquistadors, and how they reshaped an entire continent. But then on top of that, how the politics of South America are so disastrous in a lot of ways, but how a lot of that has been influenced by the meddling of non-South American powers, you know, like the CIA, and the way that it has influenced coups in various nations in Central and South America, or the influence that the Soviets and communism had on various nations in South America. And so for me, all of these dynamics are super interesting. And I think it would have been impossible for me to write a book without incorporating that to at least like a certain degree. Maybe I'm not going like full highbrow like China Mieva, who some of his works are very complex and are dealing with very complex themes. I think I'm kind of trying to find a bit of a middle ground where I'm able to have a dialogue about these things, but not necessarily bog the story down too much in, you know, sort of like academic discussions.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's kind of striking the balance between the commentary and analysis of those exactly. conflicts and important themes, but also keeping the core story. And we'll get onto the core story in a bit. And as we are still in the world building part of it, I was thinking about seeing the map that you introduced and the visual aspect, which is really important to you. As some of our listeners may know, you're among other things an illustrator, a graphic designer, and I can assume that the visual aspect of it was almost as equally important as the story itself. and seeing the motifs, the small drawings inside the book and all those elements that make it. How did you go about that? Because you did work on the cover art. You got Felix Ortiz on the cover art, but you still did a lot of stuff yourself. How was that process for you? Kind of putting some control in other people's hands, but still keeping the creative reins, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why self-pub is so perfect for me, because not that I necessarily need to have control in every single aspect, but there are certain things, especially when it comes to the presentation, that for me are really, really important. I've done the same thing with my podcast with SFF Addicts, where the sort of visual impression that people get is sort of like the adage of, you know, reading a book by its cover. Even though people say don't read a book by its cover, that's more a recommendation. And most people do read a book by its cover, or judge a book by its cover, sorry. And so it's like when you have that first impression, whether it's someone's looking through Apple Podcasts and they see the cover art of your podcast, or someone's scrolling through Amazon and they see the cover of your book, that's the first impression they get. And so even though we like to say, don't judge that, we will judge that. And that is going to be something that is done subconsciously. And so for me, that visual element is really important, which is why I was very happy and lucky to work with Felix Ortiz on the cover art. Because he's someone I know and I trust, and I was able to give him, just based on my background and in graphic design and illustration and tattoos, that I knew how to pitch him on the idea, basically. So I put together like a 8-10 page art brief that was basically like, here's like the motifs, here's the color palette, here are visual references for the city and the mushrooms, but also Henrietta and Koji, like the main two characters. And that, I think, for an artist is really beneficial, because then it takes a lot of the guesswork out of their hands, and they're able to do the thing that they're able to do best, which is the art. And so for me to be able to have someone I trust and be able to give him this sort of like concept and know that he can do something beautiful with it took a lot of weight off my shoulders. But then on top of that, I knew like, I'm going to do the typography, I'm going to do the design. And it was just a pleasure to be able to have his artwork be the basis for that, and to be able to build on top of that and use my skills as a graphic designer to enhance what he created. So in that sense, it's kind of like a collaboration more than anything. And I think that's what the self-pub process has taught me, is the importance of collaboration. And the visual elements of a book, you know, for me, it doesn't have to end at the cover. I incorporated visual elements into, you know, the beginning pages, whether it's like the title page or the copyright page. There's the map. There are graphics every 5 chapters that sort of immerse you in the mood a little bit more, whether it's like gross mold or like slimy mushrooms and stuff like that. And so for me, it's kind of like an extension of the reading experience, where the immersion factor kind of comes into it.
And it's really felt, yeah, because as I said, the map in the beginning, but then you have the glossary with kind of the ways that those two, let's say, people, but like the fungi and the humans insult each other, the way mm-hmm. that honorifics work. And from the beginning, you're kind of pulled in into that. And for me, that's really awesome, because I really do love seeing that. And for sure, in fantasy and sci-fi, we kind of came to expect that, but in a way it isn't anymore. I talked to a couple of previous guests about maps and stuff like that, and I don't see it very often, especially when it's kind of fitting into the story. So that's really something that I enjoy. And for the immersive side as well, you have an accompanying soundtrack, which is quite rare. If you see maps in some books, I think that soundtracks are even more rare. So and that was a really cool element. I didn't expect it. And I especially like the Mushroom Blues core theme, because it's kind of a last song in the soundtrack, but for me it just hits right with the ambience. And how did you go about that? When was that idea introduced? Did you have it in mind, I want to make this super immersive, or it was something like you kind of almost had the complete product and you were like, okay, I need to do this to make it even more immersive?
The soundtrack is something that I've always wanted. First of all, I will say about the maps, I do understand why a lot of people don't do them. It's basically like you have to shell out more money on top of what you've already invested into covers or cover design or interior design and editing and all that. And so I understand that as kind of a big reason for maps not being included. In my case, again, it's like I did the map myself. And so I had the added benefit of being able to incorporate these elements because I knew I have the skill set in order to make them a reality. And the soundtrack, I don't have a background in music production, but one of my best friends, I met him in Berlin, but he lives in Stockholm. He grew up in Sweden, so he's back in his home country. And he has a background in sound engineering and music production. And I just love sort of like immersive multimedia experiences, whether it's like you go to like an IMAX theater, and the just the power of that experience, being able to fully embrace the different elements and the different sort of like sensory modes that it's triggering. Whether it's the visuals and the way that the visuals are surrounding you, or the sound that is more powerful than a regular movie theater sound system. There's one multimedia experience that I went to in Tokyo when my wife and I went there in 2019. And so it's in like the dockyards of Tokyo, and it's called Team Labs Borderless. So Team Labs is kind of like a company that creates these multimedia experiences, and Borderless is this particular multimedia experience. And going into it, it's basically just like a warehouse, like a dockyard warehouse that was converted into an audiovisual experience. And you walk in there, and the rooms are, each room is set up with its own custom sort of like props and lighting systems and soundtrack and all these different elements that completely absorb you into whatever is happening in that particular room. And there are dozens of rooms. And so you get to go to all these different rooms and kind of experience this maze, but then also immerse yourself in the magic of this just like continuously sublime experience. And it felt very much like taking psychedelics. Like you had to kind of let go of certain trappings that humans fall into every day in terms of like feelings of control. And you kind of have to let that go and take in everything in such a way where you are succumbing to the immersion that the artist set out. And so for me, it's kind of like extending that into a book is really interesting, because not only can you immerse people in the world with the words, but then there's also the visual component that I just talked about. And then on top of that, having a soundtrack, and a soundtrack that was created by my friend and his friend. They created this production duo called Spore. And obviously they're both really into mushrooms too. So it was very fitting that the three of us were able to collaborate on this. And then on top of that, they've created or they've founded a new record label called Fruiting Bodies which they're going to use to release future albums for future Fungalverse books, but then also release their own stuff and start bringing in other artists. And so it was just really fitting that I know my friend has a incredible talent for music production, and I invited him to do this back in September, I believe. And he was like, yes, I would love to, but I'll get back to you tomorrow. And he came back to me the next day with a screenshot from his friend's notebook, a notebook just full of ideas and concept albums and stuff like that. And that one note just said Mycelium concept album. And so it was like symbiosis at its best, serendipity at its best. The fact that the three of us share this love for mushrooms, and they have the talent to create sounds that accentuate the world and fit in with the sort of atmosphere and mood of the book that I've written. So I was just blown away by what they created, and I'm really happy that the day the book comes out, the album will be released as well.
That's awesome, man, and a great story of you coming together. But before talking about future plans, I'd like to rewind a bit, and because you already mentioned a bunch about your travels and the idea slowly coming about, but with that dynamic lifestyle and everything in between that happened, you started the SFF Addicts in 2021, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, and yeah. Looking even further back, when did you start working on your writing, and how did you manage to juggle both rising the podcast slowly and like switching the places where you live and working on your own writing plus your graphic work? So how does that fit together?
it's all been just trial and error, pretty much. the writing has been something that I've dabbled in for a long time, but never finished anything. So I would just start stuff and not finish it. And I got really good at coming up with ideas, but not necessarily taking that idea to fruition, unfortunately. And then over the course of my 20s, just like moving around, it was a lot easier at that point, because me moving around, working as a tattoo artist was a good sort of foundation for me to reestablish myself wherever I went. Because tattoo culture kind of exists everywhere. It's just a matter of immersing yourself in that place and figuring out like, who are the people that like tattoos? Who might want one? Where do I work? But I'm used to, you know, I started tattooing out of my apartment, and I've worked in private studios, I've worked in apartment studios, I've worked in actual tattoo studios, I founded my own tattoo studio. And so it was kind of like the tattoo work and the illustration and the graphic design really went hand in hand wherever I went, pretty much. I could work freelance, I could do stuff for people across the world, and I could tattoo wherever I was. But then the pandemic hit, and everything just kind of went to shit for a lot of people. I ended up closing my studio, and that was a big turning point for me, because I realized, you know, my first son was on his way. He was going to be born just in a matter of, you know, 6 months after the pandemic really, really blew up. And I was like, I'm not tattooing anymore. You know, I'm just at home, and what do I want to do with my life and just everything that I'm doing? And writing kind of came back in that way, where I started more seriously building the Fungalverse and kind of delving deep into that research and that world building, because I had the time. But SFF Addicts was kind of like my way of creating a platform that would allow me to learn from other authors in a way that felt more professional. So it's kind of like, here's my professional environment where I'm doing a podcast and it feels a bit more official, and I'm not just inviting some author who probably doesn't know me to talk to me for like an hour and a half without that kind of like contextual notion of he does a podcast, so this is going to go out to more people kind of thing. And so the podcast was my way to just like pick the brains of really talented people and accrue as much information as I could about publishing and writing and figuring out what is going to work best for me. And at the same time, I can share that information with other people and help them make a more informed decision about the publishing path that works best for them, or new tactics for writing and genre and craft and all these different things. And so that was kind of the best decision I could have made in terms of taking my writing more seriously, because the podcast influenced my writing and encouraged my writing in such a way that there was this really beautiful feedback loop between what I was doing with the podcast and me pushing forward with my writing and improving my craft and getting to the point where I was confident enough that this is something that I would actually put out into the world, but I'm also going to do it self-pub.
And you mentioned that you already finished one book a while back. Was it something similar to this, or was something completely different?
It's set in the Fungalverse as well, but 30 years in the future. And so that was like very much a practice novel in terms of how do I do this thing and just like make all the mistakes I could possibly make and try and learn from that as best as possible. And I'm going to rework that novel and release it as the my next book. It's the beginning of a different series that takes place 30 years after everything that happens in Mushroom Blues and its sequels. And those two, I'm kind of going to go back and forth between them and just allow the Fungalverse to flesh out between those different series and then start introducing more stuff.
Awesome. I mean, I already see the seeds for multiple ways to grow. No pun intended. Yeah. But thinking about the core story, because we've already talked a lot about the world building, but the core of the story is kind of a police procedural. It's mostly like focused on a murder case, and not to spoil things, but it's kind of a hard-boiled noir in somewhat of a cyberpunkish slash weird future. But taking a look at most of your guests in SFF Addicts, and keeping in mind the fantasy are more kind of a traditional, in a sense, sci-fi background they come from, how did this genre within a genre come about for you? Was it something that you were also interested a while back as a kid, and is it something that you enjoy aside from like more traditional fantasy stories?
I think it's more that I enjoy it. You know, like Jeff Vandermeer and China Mieville have come up. Both of them have been very fluid in how they approach genre. And that's something that I've always respected, in the sense that genre doesn't have to be so confined in that way. Another big influence on me is Philip K. Dick, and his work really just veers off into very strange, very psychedelic territory. And a lot of the movies that have been based on his stuff, they've sort of taken out some of the weirdest elements. But when you read his books, like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which is what Blade Runner was based on, Blade Runner is a very refined version of what Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep was. And so that movie kind of honed in on the elements that would be, I think, the most focused narratively, but also the most marketable. And Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? It just has like some really esoteric shit going on that is fascinating within the context of what he's created. And I just love the ability for fiction to have that fluidity. Jeff Noon is another really great author who kind of, you know, blurs the boundaries of genre. He's got a great book called A Man of Shadows in the series called The Nyquist Mysteries that are very much like weird detective fiction, that each place that he goes to, like each physical space that he inhabits in each book and the case that he carries out there is sort of wrapped up in a certain, I would call it like a perceptual conceit. The first city, A Man of Shadows, is a city that's divided between day and night. The second book that he released in that series is, it's basically like, Within Without, the fourth book. I wanted to talk about that one. Within Without, which is the fourth book, is like, space itself is malleable and, you know, it's kind of like an M.C. Escher painting, but in the form of a city. And so how does an investigation take place in a space like that? And so for me, it's kind of like all the authors that I've read, who I guess most of them could be kind of included in like the new weird genre movement, have just been very inspiring in terms of, you know, me not having to restrict myself in terms of the genres that I'm incorporating into the story. And on one hand, I can really love mushrooms and I can really love themes like colonialism and want to discuss these more heavily. And at the same time, I can root that in something more familiar, like the genre conventions and structure of a police procedural. And so it allows me to, and this is something I realized from reading other authors, it grounds you in the familiar and slowly trickles in the unfamiliar in such a way where that ramps up over the course of the story and immerses you more and more as you go along. And subconsciously, you don't realize this ramping up because it happens in such a way that your brain acclimatizes to it. And so if you just kind of toss someone into full unfamiliar territory at the beginning, that's more likely for them to push away from it and be like, no, I don't know what's going on. So by rooting it in something like police procedural, murder mystery, noir, that kind of stuff that a lot of readers really love, and they have expectations already implanted in their head by everything else they've read, that I can start to introduce more and more weird elements as the story goes along. And that adds to the immersion because they've been acclimatized to it in a way that doesn't feel jarring.
That's a really good explanation. I really feel that you hit it right on the head, because thinking about it, I'm just realizing that a lot of work that we mentioned and some other that we didn't that I really love is kind of in this category that has that familiar element, especially the procedural, but bundling up the weird around it. And mm-hmm. It's kind of a sub-genre that doesn't have like a lot of things going on for it, but a lot of things that I did read or watch in it are really good. So I think that's, there is really something about it. And mm-hmm. Did you maybe play the game Disco Elysium?
Yes, I love that game so much. That game is like new weird. I think that's the only time I've ever played a video game and thought that this would fit in with that like new weird sort of canon. Maybe Dishonored could fit in there as well. It's kind of like weird fantasy. But Disco Elysium, I think in terms of its gameplay and game mechanics, is just as weird as the story itself. And so it's like, you know, Dishonored is much more familiar, I think, in terms of being first person, action, sort of like adventure RPG kind of elements and whatnot. And then the world like sort of accrues around that. But Disco Elysium's like, it's weird in so many ways that I think, I know the game was pretty successful, which is great, but I could see it pushing off a lot of people more often than not, just by the fact like the story is really fantastic and brilliantly told. But maybe it kind of caters more to like a PC gamer crowd than it does like a console gamer crowd.
I think so, because, you know, especially the first version that didn't have the voiceovers they added later in the Deluxe One, it is a lot of reading and a lot of esoteric stuff, and I think that's really catered to a specific crowd, but it's I think that's maybe more of a big crowd than we expected, because when you think about it in these terms, like, this is something that's weird and off-putting, but it's managed to become a hit. And unfortunately, I was looking for the book that the author of one of the authors of the Disco Elysium wrote, but I think it still hasn't been translated. It's in Estonian, which unfortunately cannot speak. So I think that exists somewhere, so hopefully we'll get a translation at some point.
I would love to read that, man. I didn't even know that one of the creators or one of the writers of that game wrote a book as well.
I think that's the guy that came up with the setting, and I think that's set in the world, but it's not related to the game story, but it's kind of a shared world.
Wow. Yeah, because that game is brilliant, and just in terms of, like, the way that the story unfolds and its characterization, and I really love unreliable narrators, too, and the ways in which a story can be told to you and kind of convince you of certain things just based on the fact that this is the POV character and that's how they perceive the world. But then when you start to realize that this is unreliable, it's such a beautiful trickery of the mind for a reader to go through that experience and understand, like, everything I'm reading is a lie. You know what I mean? It's like Portal. You know, like, the cake is a lie, but it's like, this book is a lie, you know, or like, at least what the narrator is telling me is a lie, because their psychology is skewed, and Disco Elysium really represents that beautifully. It was one of my original comps, but the people that I first showed that sort of, like, comp tag to were like, what is Disco Elysium? And my heart just kind of broke bit by bit, you know?
I had the lack of having almost all of the people that I gushed to about this Elysium try it and like it as well, so yeah. I feel I'm lucky in that way. But circling back to narrators and that POEs, that can be a lot trickier when you have those unreliable narrators, especially if you reach out for something that's kind of almost a gimmick. We had a lot of memorable things that tie into unreliable narrators, but it's getting tougher to pick out something that hasn't been done to that. And speaking of that, how did you land upon your POV? You have basically two main characters that bounce off each other, but you have one strong POV. Was it a dilemma for who to have the eyes of the audience, or you know exactly who you wanted to place there?
No, I knew exactly who I wanted to. So Koji is a character that I created for the novel that I wrote before Mushroom Blues, but just, like, older Koji. Mm-hmm. And so Mushroom Blues started as an idea for a giveaway, like a freebie that I would give to people when they signed up for my newsletter. But I realized this idea and this sort of the time in which this takes place, there's just so much more here. And so I started to elaborate upon it. And the main character, Henrietta Hoffman, actually started out as a man, but which is really, really typical for like detective stories and noir and that kind of stuff. And it just didn't really click with me. Like, I would try to write him and it just didn't feel like there was a good flow. And so I decided, okay, like, that was third person and a man. And so I switched to a woman POV, and it was still a little bit clunky. And so I switched to a first person perspective, and that's when everything really fit into place. And it worked so well because Henrietta, this story is very much hers in terms of the experience that she's having being a stranger in a strange land. She's new to Neokonoko. She's new to this city of fungals and this, you know, post-war occupied city. But she comes from the nation of Caprinia, which is the human nation that invaded. And so she has kind of like the baggage that she's bringing from home but also the immense insecurity that comes from being in a new place. And a lot of what Henrietta is experiencing is based on my own life. You know, like living in different places around the world, I've felt that sense of loneliness and sort of alienation, being in a new place and being in a culture that you don't understand, not speaking the language well, and just feeling like you are an outsider in your day-to-day experience. And so for Henrietta, it's like this clash of worlds. And on top of that, she's mycophobic. So she actually has an innate disgust and fear of mushrooms and everything fungal. And so for her, it's like being in Neokonoko is literal hell. To be surrounded by mushrooms all the time is just like she's not having it. And there's body horror elements too that come into play, which really amplify the disgust for the reader and also take away agency from Henrietta, even if just for a moment, to show you that she's vulnerable in this situation and in this world. And so for me, it was really important for her to be in a place that she's uncomfortable in and to be confronted with the realities of how human and relatable the fungal people actually are, but that being disjointed from the cultural programming that she experienced in Caprinia and then coming to Neokonoko and still dealing with, because all of the humans have this racial prejudice towards the fungal people. They are disgusted by them. They call them slurs. The military and the police mistreat them. There are protests that turn into riots and all these different kinds of clashes that are going on. And Henrietta is just experiencing all of this. And ultimately the story is her having to come to grips with what her culture has programmed her to think and the psychological fears that she has, whether it's, you know, mycophobia or what have you, or the traumas of her past and the baggage that she brings with her. All of this is forcing her to confront the realities of what she's experiencing. And through literal sort of like mushroom induced sort of psychedelic experience, she... And the sort of like micro experiences that she has along the way, really pushing her to open her mind and decide for herself what is her version of the truth, as opposed to what is the truth that has been sold to her by her culture, by her nation, by her government.
Yeah, that sounds kind of when you think about like shifting perspectives, the decision to go the first person route was the right one. Yeah. Because as you were saying, the body horror part, which I wanted to mention as well, I definitely squirmed in some places, and yeah. The tactile part of it and the smells, I think that you really managed to emphasize those parts of her and the parts of the world that she interacts with in such a way, and for me that was really important. It's not just kind of a set dressing. We have those mushrooms in the background, but everything is pretty much the same. But the things that she deals with from like page one and the spores and everything, not to spoil anything for people, but man, I think that a lot of people are going to discover some new things about themselves.
They're either going to come away from this being more fascinated or more disgusted by mushrooms. But either way is fine for me.
Or maybe both, thinking, as I was.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like, for me, if you're thinking more about mushrooms and the sort of beautiful sort of intricacies of this kingdom of organisms, for me, it's like I couldn't just make it set dressing. Just like the Japanese influences that I've incorporated, I couldn't just make it set dressing because that would sell it short. So it's like I had to incorporate the mushrooms and I had to incorporate the Japanese influences in such a way where the society feels very natural and very integrated and like it existed for thousands of years before this story took place, even though I haven't gone nearly that far back in the history of this world. but it's just kind of like the illusion that you set by creating a world that is immersive in such a way where it's like the right details sell a reader on the fact that this world is more than what it shows on the page.
And writing it in some like iterations, did you go back and fill in those details? How did that look like, and how many versions of your draft were there?
I didn't have that many versions of it, to be honest, but it was more like the first draft process from when I started to when I ended. I knew that I had to rewrite a bunch of the beginning in order to incorporate things that I'd come up with along the way. So for instance, like the fungal network that the fungal people have, which is sort of like a mycological, biological, interconnected communication network that the fungal people have. It can kind of feel like a magic system in a lot of ways, because they can communicate with each other like telepathically, essentially. So I kind of had to like, I came up with that like more fully fleshed out over the course of writing the first draft. And then going back, I had to sort of reintegrate it and rework and see how it would best fit within the whole story. And at the same time, like a good magic system, I had to put restrictions on it that wouldn't come back to bite me in the ass later, because it's like, oh, we need to do this thing, but this solves that instantly. You know what I mean? And it kind of robs potential story moments of tension. And so I had to put restrictions on it in terms of like, you can't just like send a text message to someone like 500 kilometers away or anything like that. But it's more like a localized thing, and it's more based on emotions than anything. So it's like the fungals can sort of perceive the emotions of those around them, and they're so attuned to that they can read these emotional expressions or the body language of somebody else and kind of interpret that sensory information. Or there are other ways in which they can literally relive and or sort of experience the memories of somebody else. But that's a much more invasive process. And it's something that could either be done, you know, willingly and with consent, or it's something that can be used in a much more torturous way. And so it's kind of like I had to put these restrictions on it, in the sense that you can't just like communicate with anybody at any time and ruin so many aspects of the story. And I think what ended up happening is going through those iterations and kind of refining what it is made the fungal net much more interesting. And it feels much more naturally integrated into these people and their society and the things that they're doing over the course of this book.
So it's kind of a combination of plotting and pantsing for you.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, like what I do is kind of like a discovery outline where I'm going through the outline plot process and kind of winging it and seeing what happens, but not going into too much detail. And then the first draft is much more using what I've set up in the outline, but not restricting myself too much to that. So giving myself enough freedom, but also enough foundation that I can move the story forward. And then the drafts after that is kind of like a lot of, you know, fixing major parts that aren't working, or straight up like in the first draft, I'll just have parts in like square brackets where I'm like, insert X here, because I don't have the fucking brain space to do this right now, so I'm just going to do it later. Or, you know, going back and fixing up pacing and stuff like that, or telegraphing certain things with foreshadowing that I didn't know existed at the beginning of the first draft, but I knew happened by the time I finished the first draft. So I could go back and kind of leave little clues and foreshadowing and stuff like that, that enhance the experience for the reader.
When do you know that like a scene or a chapter is complete for you? I can assume that as many of us do, you can fix it forever. But yeah. When do you know you're set, like, this is as good as I will get it this time and I'll just leave it?
Yeah, that's kind of a tricky one. For me, it's mostly like, does it hit the sort of beats that I wanted it to? And are the emotional moments impactful enough? Because, you know, like going in and just kind of tweaking, like one sentence here and one sentence there is not going to change much in the grand scheme of things. It's like, is this scene well-paced? Is it impactful in terms of what I wanted it to do? And is it consistent with everything else that is happening in the story? So if the character does something like really out of left field and it's like, this is not something that that character would do, so I'd need to go back and fix it. But that's like a much more fundamental problem to have to fix. So for the most part, it comes down to those things of like, does it hit those beats? Does it have that right emotional impact? And does it feel consistent? And, you know, proofreaders will catch the major spelling mistakes and grammatical errors or whatever. But for the most part, it's that for me.
And speaking of consistency, at the start of each chapter, you have the timestamp, like at which point of the day it's happening. And I was wondering when I read it, was that tricky syncing up things? Because you do have some long stretches of things happening. It's not just like a short scene, then fast forward. You do have like one take scenes. And how did that go about, you know, figuring out the right amount of time to allocate to some of that?
I mean, a lot of that, the timestamps I actually put in later on after the first draft, but it was mostly to help me keep track of like when things were happening, to be honest, to kind of have a sense of like, when does this particular thing start? Where is it happening? And is it logical, because I also have the map in there, I could actually kind of like map this out. Is it logical for them to be able to go from this place after this thing has happened and then go to this next place? You know what I mean? And so that was really big for me. But also it fit well in terms of the Hoffman report being a report, and it's kind of like Henrietta recounting her experiences, doing these different cases. And so that fit well in the sense like it has the case number, but it also has like the location and the time. So it feels more immersive in the sense of she's being very, very detail oriented about where she is and what she's doing and when. So that you can imagine this is all printed out and put into like a manila envelope or something like that and given to her captain or something, you know, or given to the captain's secretary and filed away. And so for me, it was kind of like this multi-faceted use case of using those timestamps and using the locations to keep track of things for myself, but also give the reader a sense of like what's happening and where the character is and where they end up going. And in the case of the scenes themselves, sometimes there are certain chapters and certain sort of like continuation of scenes that feel like they necessitate a much more direct continuity. Whereas other cases, it's like, you know, something will happen and Henrietta will, you know, tell Koji, like, you know, go home, you stink like shit, go shower, grab a bite to eat, and we'll meet up at a certain place at a certain time. And I'm not necessarily going to go home with Henrietta and show her having a shower and show her eating and et cetera, et cetera. And so it's basically like, what are the necessities of that chapter? And does the chapter that comes after necessitate a continuity of what the finale of this particular chapter set up And so it's kind of all about that, like, that setup and that sequel, like the sequential nature of it, essentially.
And speaking of the future and continuations, you mentioned that we're likely to see Koji 30 years in the future. And what else does the Fungal Wars keep for us? Like, do you already have mapped out where in timelines are you going to go? How do you see it in, like, few years, 10 years, whatever you like to set, like, a time frame?
Yeah, I've got it all mapped out because I'm just like that. That's, like, my personality. So I have... The Hoffman Report is 4 books, and those 4 books are more or less like standalone mysteries, but interconnected based on some of the overarching events that are happening in Neokonoko and the surrounding areas, but also Henrietta and Koji and their sort of flourishing friendship. So they have kind of that through line over the course of 4 books in the Hoffman Report. And the Hoffman Report and its ending actually kind of reflects upon the other trilogy, which is the Konoko trilogy. That's the next book I'm going to be putting out as the first book in that. And that is set 30 years in the future, incorporating a lot more biotech and fungal tech and cyberpunk elements. Ghost in the Shell is a really big inspiration for this series, as well as Deus Ex. And so there's kind of like a mix of, we've got Koji and he's older and he's investigating a murder, but he's a lot more jaded. And then we also have things like big crime gangster families. We have a human who is working at a mega corporation and sort of like going through like corporate espionage and stealing IP and these different kinds of things, and how all of that plays into the sociopolitical elements of Neokonoko at that time. So that one's 3 books. And then in the future, you know, I'll just kind of like start introducing these as well as doing stuff outside of the Fungalverse. But I have a duology that is basically Fungal Samurai set hundreds of years in the past. I've got the Spore War, which is going to be a standalone that takes place during the Spore War, which is mentioned in Mushroom Blues. And then I have some short story collections as well that I'll bring in at certain times to kind of flesh out minor characters or flesh out time periods in between stories and just kind of give a little extra taste to readers of the world beyond the people that they experience in the main series.
Amazing. I mean, those all sound exciting, so I'm really looking forward to them, and I hopefully they'll all find their audience. And yeah. Before I let you go, I need to flip the script and hit you with your own questions. I need one weird fact from you, one weird random fact to leave us on, and one soundbite of writing advice.
Look at you. Damn, man. Okay. Ooh, okay. A weird or random fact. I feel like I have to do a mushroom one just because because they're so integral. Okay, so this is one that many people might know, or they may have heard of the term, but mushrooms in terms of their relationship in ecosystems, many of them have what's called a mycorrhizal relationship with trees. And many of the trees that exist on the planet are only able to exist as they are, to grow as big as they do, or for the forests of Earth to have the density that they have. A lot of it depends on this mycorrhizal relationship where mycelium and the roots of trees called rhizomes, which is where mycorrhizal comes from, are sort of involved in a symbiotic relationship where the trees are bringing in carbon dioxide and releasing it as oxygen, which the mycelium is then absorbing, because mushrooms, also another random fact, mushrooms, much like humans, they breathe in oxygen and they exhale carbon dioxide. And so that is kind of what the mushrooms are taking in. And then the mushrooms are taking in the nutrients that they absorb from decomposed material from the soil around them, things like nitrogen, and they're infusing that into the rhizomes, which then help the tree to survive and thrive. And so without this, most of the world that we know today would not exist. So we have mushrooms to thank for Earth and its current state and its current beauty. So if you ever hate on mushrooms, just remember the world that you exist in is responsible because of mushrooms.
Awesome.
And writing advice. This is the difficult one because I've learned a lot from SF Fanatics and from all the authors that I've gotten to know. But find your community. Doesn't matter if it's, doesn't really matter like what avenue that takes. It's like, if you don't want to be on Twitter, you don't have to be on Twitter. There are book communities all over the place. They're on Instagram, they're on TikTok, they're on YouTube with booktubers, there are podcasts. There are so many different ways that you can listen and absorb different voices. But for me, the big thing is to kind of get out there and connect with people. Because you're going to see, if you're just a reader, it feels really good to talk to other readers about the books that you're reading. It feels really awesome when you talk to the authors whose books you're reading. And that is just like an exhilarating experience. But then if you're an author, community is so important. And if you eschew that really important part of being an author, you're going to find yourself lacking in terms of support, in terms of socialization, because being a writer is already lonely enough. So it's really beneficial to get out there and to talk to other like-minded people who understand what you're going through. And then at the same time, you can connect with people that are, you know, in the reading community, in the blogging community, the podcasting community, the booktubing community. And the SFF community especially is very welcoming. And if you're not a dick, you're just genuine and you're you and you're representing your true self online, you know, you're going to find people that you really connect with. And in my case, I've found, you know, lifelong friends by doing this. So I can't recommend enough. Get involved in the community, but, you know, do it in a way that feels comfortable for you and connect with other people, because that's what's going to sustain you more than anything else.
I feel that's a great note to end on. Thank you, Adrian. This is really great. I had so much fun talking to you, and thank you for coming on to Storyline Sessions. I wish you all the success with the Fungalverse, and we'll see how it turns out, but I'm sure it will be exciting.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it. And also, congratulations to you, man. Like, I've been watching you since you started the podcast, and it's just great to have more voices in the community and to see your podcast growing bit by bit. So yeah, man, just like keep it up.
Thank you so much. Bye, Adrian. Yeah.
Bye, man. Appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Storyline Sessions podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I'll put the relevant link for both Adrian's work and his SFF Addicts podcast in the description. If you're interested in creative writing and storytelling in any kind of media, keep following the Storyline Sessions both here and on Instagram. My name is Marko Bogdanović, and I'll see you next week. Keep creating stories.